Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth lecture in the course on Perspectives on Bhikkhuni Ordination, organized by the University of Hamburg, by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies, and the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative. Today is the fourth lecture. This lecture will be on the Mula Savasivada Vinaya, on the formation of Bhikkhunis. And we are very happy to have with us Dhamche Diana Finnegan, who will talk to us on this topic. Venerable Dhamche, also known in academic circles under her name Diana Finnegan, did her postgraduate work in Greek philosophy at New School for Social Research in New York. She received her Shramanelika vows, these are the novice ordination, in 1999. And she began graduate school shortly thereafter. She did her PhD in 2009 from the University of Wisconsin Medicine's Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia. Her PhD is a dissertation on gender and ethics in Buddhist monasticism, drawing on the narratives of the Mula Savasivada Vinaya. And we are very fortunate to have access to her PhD. It is part of the recommended readings. So you can also enjoy, or have a chance to enjoy the profundity of her research. She founded Dhammadatanan's community, a community of Western Shramanerikas training in India under the guidance of His Holiness the 17th Karmapa, Ogyen Trinle Dorje. And she is very much aspiring to receive Bhikshuni ordination, Bhikshuni vows, in accordance with the Mula Savasivada Vinaya. She currently lives in India and is engaged in research, translation and editing projects. She mainly serves on publication projects of the 17th Karmapa. Most recently, she co-translated and edited The Heart is Noble, Changing the World from the Inside Out, by His Holiness the 17th Karmapa. I actually have the book here, so you can see it. Such a beautiful smile, no? Yeah, I always keep that book by the side of my working place, so I have somebody smiling at me. Good. So far for the introduction, I'll stop now and leave you all to Venerable Dhamche and her exposition.
Thank you so much, Bhikkhu Analeo. As has been mentioned, and as you all know, this is the fourth lecture in this series. And this course combines an exploration of the issue of Bhikkhuni ordination from a textual perspective, as well as from an anthropological or sociological perspective, where we're exploring, giving a survey of the situation of nuns and female renunciates in the Theravada and Mula Savasivada traditions. So until now, you've primarily been reviewing the textual traditions of the Dharmagupta and the Theravada Vinayas. And coming next, the course will be turning to the situation of female renunciates in Sri Lanka. So the course itself is spanning these two sort of spheres where Bhikshuni ordination issues get worked out. One is within the text that regulate monastic life, and the other is in the world where women are actually having to live their lives as renunciates. And so I will be looking at the Mula Savasivada Vinaya, which is in the area of a textual presentation. But at the same time, I'm primarily looking in terms of the narratives, not the rules and regulations regulating Bhikshuni ordination or stipulating how it could be conducted, but the messy world of living out the life of a Bhikshuni as it's imagined or presented within the narratives of the Mula Savasivada Vinaya. And so this is an opportunity for us to sort of bridge into the next step, where we start imagining how the issues that are involved in receiving or choosing not to receive and living as a Bhikshuni in the world might take place. And I think actually one of the issues that might be useful for us to have in mind as we work through the stories and the presentation of this week is, what is the relationship between the textual tradition, between the Vinaya as a text and the Vinaya as a lived way of life within Buddhist monasticism? And I think maybe we can turn to the next slide, which is my job to do. So one of the questions that is worth thinking about as we're going through this course is, how are we using the Vinaya text in relation to this issue of bhikshuni ordination? And I think most commonly what we see happening is that very often the Vinaya text is assumed to be a sort of legal code that we can use to figure out what would be valid according to the procedural expectations, what would be legally valid way of confirming the bhikshuni vows. And at the same time, we often are looking within the Vinaya text for evidence on historical precedents for how this could be done. And so here the Vinaya text, we're relating with the Vinaya text as a legal code, and it's telling, we're asking certain questions of the text that it then is answering us. And I think it's just worth noting that this is not the only way that Vinaya text have been used or could be used, obviously, in terms of a scholarly engagement with the Vinaya text, and with this Vinaya text in particular, the Mula Savastivada Vinaya text, which I should mention, just in case it's not perfectly clear already, that the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya is the Vinaya that regulates Tibetan Buddhism. It was accepted as the only Vinaya that was allowed to be translated into the Tibetan language, and it was stipulated by decree and has been universally accepted that it would be the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya and only the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya that would be used within Tibetan Buddhism. And so when scholars are looking at this particular Vinaya, they ask many different questions apart from the question of bhikshuni ordination. So we have Gregory Chopin, who's asked of the text, what sort of financial transactions were Buddhist monasteries involved in? Shane Clark has asked, what kinds of family relationships did Buddhist monastics have? And they're using this text, they're sort of mining the text for information about these kinds of activities. So just for us to sort of be aware that the way that we approach the text and what we're looking to receive from the text does affect what we will find and does affect also our particular engagement with the text. And of course, for the monastics who have used the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya as their guide to monastic life, or as the text that regulates and that guides the process of being a Buddhist monastic within that tradition, we're asking questions like, how should I live my life? What is the right way for me to behave? How should I train? And so the questions that we're asking most often when we're talking about bhikshuni ordination have been, how can we do it? How can we establish a bhikshuni lineage or bhikshuni tradition within the Vinaya, given the historical conditions that we're facing today? Now, one other question that is important for us to ask is, what kind of a text is the Vinaya? And since we're specifically looking at the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, the question that we would ask here is, what sort of a text is the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya? And I think one of the very first things that we notice when we're looking at it is an enormous text. It fills 13 volumes of, you know, potis that are so thick, you know, 500, 600 pages, folio sides. So you can look at how much text manages to be fit into one text. You can see on the PDF that there are almost 8,000 pages. And there's a saying that quantity has a quality all its own. And I think it's used tongue in cheek, but in this case, I think it does have some relevance, because when you are talking about a text that is that long, for most ordinary people, that's more than can be memorized. It's more than can be maybe really grappled with or held in mind for most of the people whose lives are going to be regulated by this vinaya. And at the same time, a text that long inevitably has an enormous amount of internal diversity. Come to the next page. And within that universal, that diversity, that great diversity that we find internal to the vinaya, we also find a proliferation of different genres of text, different kinds of texts are encompassed within the vinaya. And so, you know, our engagement with it as a legal code suggests that we are ignoring a very large percentage of what's there. So we need to think about whether that's an appropriate way to read the text, and also just to be willing to inflect our reading of it as a legal code by the presence of all these other genres. And so when we go through and review some of the different genres that are there, we start to get a sense that the vinaya is actually doing a lot of different functions, and it's performing, it's having a lot of different aims that it's accomplishing. So within the vinaya, we have many passages that in which we are listening to a discourse by the Buddha. Either it's quoting the Buddha giving a discourse, or people are quoting to one another large passages, or sometimes shorter passages, or just a verse that Buddha has said. So we have sutra material embedded within the vinaya. We have ritual manuals telling us how to perform different rites that are related with Buddhist monastic life. We have a cosmology. We have a very detailed and very, very interesting account of how the world was created. We have histories of kingdoms, the vinaya itself, the Mulasavastra vinaya itself, as it has been in the order in which it's structured in the Tibetan translation, which may or may not parallel what was there in the Sanskrit manuscripts. They begin with a history of the major kings that were, the kingdoms that were effective during the time of the Buddha's birth. We have within Sanskrit, some of the richest material for biographies of the Buddha is within the vinaya. There are many, many jatakas, stories of the past life of Buddha. The chapter on medicine, the Bhaisajavastu, has over 100 pages of one jataka story after another. And if the question comes up, what does that have to do with medicine? That's an important question, actually, which I don't think we can answer, certainly not in this lecture. There are also a tremendous amount of avadana material, so stories of the past lives of other figures besides the Buddha, and lots of biographical material. But more than anything, we have narratives. We have narratives, narratives, and more narratives. And the narratives that we find have a certain relationship to the rules, where ostensibly a rule, or as it's presented, a rule is the response to a specific situation that arises. And sometimes the specific situation that arises can be 40 pages, and then there's one thing that is either a rule or some sort of indication or instruction to the monastic community as to what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. Now, when we look at the way the relationship between the vinaya text, the vinaya as a text, and Buddhist monasticism as a way of life or as a historical and social institution, one of the functions that the vinaya text has in relationship to Buddhist monasticism is to regulate or to serve as an authority. And so in that sense, the Buddhist monastic traditions themselves are reading the Vinaya as an authoritative text. And the Vinaya itself, I think, is complicating for us what exactly... Just one second, are we on the right page? Yes. The Vinaya itself, the Mula Savasa Vinaya, includes within it the description of the Buddha's instructions were on his deathbed, and then what happened afterwards, the councils that took place afterwards. And so we have a very interesting situation where we have this text that is serving to monastics as their authority. And the text itself is telling us, I am not the authority that Buddha wanted to regulate you. Okay? That's a little bit provocative, so I need to back it up. So within the Shudakavastu, we have narrated the account of the Buddha's last days. And during those last days, there's a comment on his deathbed that the Buddha makes, and he says, Bhikshus, after I, the teacher, have passed away, you should not entertain the thought that your teacher is not there and there is no teacher, because I have instructed you how to recite the Pratimoksha Sutra every half month. So the Pratimoksha Sutra, he's telling us on his deathbed, yes, that is authoritative, you will be reciting that sutra. Then he says, from today onwards, it is your teacher, and it is the teacher. Then he says, and this is the key point for us, Bhikshus having come together, the assembly should make clarifications among the trifling and minor rules of training and live at ease. So the Buddha, and then this is repeated later, and effectively the Buddha is saying, and there's another quote which I won't read now because I'm a little bit concerned about time, but where the Buddha is saying that the major rules should be preserved, but the minor rules can be adapted. And then what happens later is that Mahakashyapa assumes leadership of the Sangha, and it is made clear that, or a census emerges under his leadership, that in fact, because Ananda, when this statement was made by the Buddha, did not follow up and say, which of the rules are major and which of the rules are minor, that we are not able to say which ones they are. And there was squabbling apparently among the Sangha or disagreement among the Sangha as to which precisely constituted. And so there was a concern expressed by Mahakashyapa that the Sangha is, we're going to really look very confused if we're not clear about this issue. And that in order to preserve the longevity and the continuity of the Vinaya and therefore of the Sangha, that in fact we cannot change any of the rules. And we will take the body of instructions as we received them from the Buddha, the decisions that were made by the Buddha during his lifetime, and that's it for all eternity, effectively, or for as long as the teachings remain. And so Buddha has empowered the Sangha, or the monks, at least in this formulation, he's empowered the bhikshus to act collectively as lawmakers. And by doing that, he's ensuring that something that we see the Buddha doing within the Vinaya again and again can continue, which is adapting the rules as particular situations arise. Adapting the rules, adjusting, changing in response to changing circumstances. And what happens instead is the Vinaya is effectively, according as the text itself is presenting itself to us, the text, the Vinaya is saying, this is it. We're freezing it right here. And what we have right here at this moment is what will be transmitted forever. Now, it's worth noting, of course, that there are multiple Vinayas, and none of them are acknowledging the presence of others. Each of them presents themselves as the Vinaya that was given during the lifetime of the Buddha and was transmitted in this unchanging way, you know, from then on. and they're different. So historically, we know that clearly there was adaptation that took place to the formulation of the Vinaya as it had, from the time it was received from Buddha until the time that it was effectively canonized or established, fixed in a certain form. However, the text itself is saying to us, I am the authority. This is the authority, the only authority, and this is not what Buddha wanted to be the authority. He wanted the Vinaya to respond to changing circumstances. So we've got a very complicated sort of authority that, in a sense, is eroding its own position. So at the same time, we have this understanding that this is not exactly what the Buddha, you know, this is what he intended during his lifetime, but he did not intend this to continue per se as if it were set in stone. Now, the other factor that I think is important for us to be aware of is that although we're treating the rules as if they were set in stone, when we look at the legislative style, shall we say, of the Buddha, it was the rules that he handed down looked very much more like they were set in water. And I would like to just give one example of that, where we can see that the vision that the Buddha had of his practice as a legislator was it was situation driven. It was responding to the particulars that were arising. And he was very willing to change the rules. So, and we can see this from the narratives, and this is the interplay and the importance, I think, of looking at the narratives, that narratives are telling you the situation in response to which certain legislative rulings were made, or in which the Buddha articulated a certain guideline for the future. And that future could be very short. It could be from one day to the next, and the rule could be changed, that it could be changed very, very frequently. So one example that I think makes this quite vivid, there's a bhikshuni named Stulananda. She's the naughty nun. She's the one thanks to whom we have many, many of the rules. Many of the rules for bhikshunis are articulated in response to some transgressive behavior that she was engaging in. And in this case, Stulananda has been teaching men when their wives are not present, and she's been telling the women's secrets to the men. And this causes a lot of problems. The women are very unhappy. They don't want to give any more alms. So this situation is brought to the Buddha's attention, and he therefore makes a rule saying, bhikshunis should not teach. So the bhikshunis aren't teaching, and because they stop teaching, the lay people start giving alms. They say, well, you can't give us any teachings, we can't give you any food. So this situation is brought to the Buddha's attention. So first rule is bhikshunis can't teach. Next rule is, this is the fact that they are going to starve if they're not allowed to teach the Dharma, because of the symbiotic relationship between the offering of dana and the offering of alms. So the complaint comes, and the Buddha then makes a rule. He says, okay, then the bhikshuni should teach in 5 lines. They should just teach a little bit. So they don't know what the 5 lines are, and the Buddha explains that then what you should say is, householders, form is impermanent, feelings, discernment, compositional factors, and consciousness are impermanent. That's the teaching. So they begin to give this 5-line teaching, and the householders complain, and they say that you are the lay supporters complain, and they're saying that you're being stingy with your teaching, so we'll be stingy with our food. We'll give food, but we'll give much less food. And so this is brought to the Buddha's attention. Then the next rule, so now we're on the third ruling that he's made on the same matter. As the situation continues and it's clear that the lay people are not going to be satisfied with their 5 lines of teachings, he says, then you may teach, then teach, the Dharma is to be taught in 6 lines. So then again, he explains how you teach in 6 lines, and he uses the 6 sense faculties. So then they teach, the story continues and it evolves and there are multiple iterations until finally the rule is made that bhikshunis may teach men when there is a woman present who understands, an understanding female who's present. So the rule has gone through multiple changes. It's tweaked repeatedly. And then basically what we're left with is the final ruling, you know, at the time that situation was closed. Presumably had a similar situation arisen and new circumstances, new conditions start taking place, that could have been changed. So what we're seeing is the Buddha himself is treating the rules as if they're set in stone and he'll just change them. Now, he's the Buddha, so he has the right to change them. But we understand from his own relationship to the rules is that they are very, very situational. Now, by contrast, the Vinaya as it's being transmitted is as if it were universal for all times, regardless of the circumstances, in the text, in the form that the text is being passed down. So this already we see that there's quite a serious tension within the spirit of the law and the letter of the law and the way that the two are actually being conflated. So the other aspect of the text wherein there is so much narrative which when read in connection with the rules can actually either lend ambiguity to what the spirit of the rule seems to be or what the rule seems to be in response to. But also the sheer length and volume of the text, the fact that there are so many voices that are being heard in relationship to any situation, the Mula Savastavada Vinaya is basically superseded within Tibetan Buddhist practice. Possibly in India, this we don't have enough historical evidence to say with any real confidence, but certainly by the time the Vinaya is being practiced and adopted within Tibetan Buddhism, and certainly nowadays, the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya itself, the Vinaya text itself, is seldom read. When I was doing my dissertation research, it was very difficult to find scholars who had actually read the Vinaya itself. What they read instead is a text that they call the root Vinaya, which is not the Vinaya. It is a commentarial text in sutras or in short aphoristic phrases, which need to have a commentary to be explained. And this is 6th century Gunaprabha's Vinaya Sutra. It's a sutra, not in the sense of being discourses of the Buddha, but sutra in the sense of being aphoristic, short phrases, which can be memorized, which are very concise, and which have effectively the function of being able to eliminate some of the ambiguity, a lot of the ambiguity, and clarify and make things much more black and white than they necessarily were, and certainly much less nuanced in terms of the particulars of the different situations that were arising. And so the challenge in trying to use the Vinaya text that has so many voices and that is so attentive to detail and to particulars, to use a particularist text as a universalist sort of legislative vehicle are resolved by shifting to the Vinaya Sutra. And so the Vinaya Sutra and the commentaries, the auto-commentary by Gunaprabha and all of the commentarial texts that each of the Tibetan Buddhist, the schools of Tibetan Buddhism will have their own preferred commentaries, Tibetan, indigenous commentaries on the Vinaya Sutra will be used as the authoritative text regulating Buddhist monastic life within Tibetan Buddhism. So we have the form and the content of the Mula Savastavada Vinaya are pulling in different directions. the literary genre and the actual use to which it's pulled in different directions. And the tradition itself is pulling the vinaya to serve in a certain purpose. Now, another way for us to think about what kind of a text the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya is, we can listen to how the great French Indologist Sylvain Lévy, how he described it, and he called it in 1932 a masterpiece of Sanskrit literature. And he describes it as having clearly been produced by someone whose, quote, verbal enthusiasm and rampant imagination evoke the memory of Rabelais and the best of Rabelais. So this is a very quick way for us to recognize that we are in different territory than a legal code. And also to alert us, especially in terms of the reference to Rabelais, is it's peopled with, it's teeming with life. It's very, very interested in the peculiarities and the particularities of the experience of the people in its world. And the richness of the imagination or the narrative eye on the panorama of life that it is presenting makes the vinaya very entertaining, very engaging, and looking at the language, particularly in Sanskrit, it's very elegant. It's a sparse style, but it's a very elegant style. So these are just to help us to nuance a little bit our understanding of what kind of a thing the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya is. Now, just in terms of the uses that we are wanting to make of the text to help us in thinking about the CUNY ordination or to actually be involved in the process of establishing the CUNY ordination within Tibetan Buddhism, which is now very much a topic. One thing for us to just bear in mind when we're making this sort of historical use of the text is that by, I think, the earliest that we could conceivably argue for the text having been stabilized and redacted in the form in which it began to circulate, in the form in which we now have it, is certainly not any earlier than the first or second century Common Era. So many, many centuries after the history that it is purporting to be depicting, describing. And, you know, we have the tradition telling us that it was circulated orally and then just written down at a later point. But the quantity having a quality all its own is relevant because you're talking about 8,000 pages. And so for us to just try to imagine that there were generation after generation after generation, there are people who've memorized 8,000 pages and then it gets written down later, which is the self-presentation of the text itself, the self-presentation that it was faithfully preserved. So we have some real issues in wanting to use the text as a window into the history of that time. And even were it the case that it had been written contemporaneous with the events that are being presented in it, we still can't get around the issue of politics of representation. A narrative text is a representation of events in which certain details are brought to the fore, assuming that everything is strictly factual, right? We're still selecting among the facts that get presented, and also how they're presented clearly is a very important factor. And if we're not aware of the politics of representation, we assume that we are simply reading a faithful description that is sort of mimetically, you know, mirroring actual reality, we are simply going to be unknowingly and unawarely subjecting ourselves to the authority of that representation. And so specifically when we're talking about gender, we are looking at representations of what the position of women were, how bhikshunis were allowed to form, how that process evolved, and then what their life was like afterwards, what the bhikshuni community was. Now, when we're reading the Mula Sarvastravada Vinaya for gender in particular, I think that a couple of things to notice. The first one is that the Mula Sarvastravada Vinaya is very aware of gender. It's aware of the difference between the social positions that a human being will have based on being a woman or a man. It's aware of how this limits people, and we'll go through in the stories that we'll be reviewing. Just keeping an eye on time. We will have an opportunity to see how gender was conceived. One thing that is important to recognize when you're looking at narratives. Narratives literally preserve multiple voices. They are multivocal. This is one of the reasons why it is so difficult to use the Mula Sarvastravada Vinaya as an authority, is that it's articulating many different visions just by virtue of being narrative. And so how to read a text responsibly that is multivocal, in which you're giving the opportunity to hear lots of different concerns and lots of different subjectivities and lots of different imagined perspectives, and yet we are assuming that the text itself has the final word. What is that word when there's so many different voices speaking at the same time? So when we look at the Mula Sarvastravada Vinaya's presentation about women, women are all over the Mula Sarvastravada Vinaya. So the Vinaya itself, there's one volume of the 13 that is dedicated to nuns, to the bhikshunis' vows, but women and bhikshunis appear in every single volume, including all of the volumes that are dedicated to bhikshus. And that the women that we see they're involved in receiving the Dharma, they're involved in giving the Dharma, they are from all different walks of life. There are prostitutes and queens and the wives of leading merchants and beggars and young women and widows and old women and servants. And we have, because it's narrative and the particular narrative style that the Vinaya takes, we hear their thoughts sometimes. We do have the narrator commenting sometimes on what the women think. So women's voices are included, and their subjectivity, their experiences are imagined by the narrator and presented to us. Another factor that's very, I think, important to be aware of is that the narrator or narrators absolutely acknowledge misogyny. There's one account of how the Buddha has asked the monks to give teachings to the nuns, and they're doing it in turn, and there's one monk who doesn't want to bother, so he doesn't turn up, and he's called to task on this by the Buddha, and then has no choice, he has to teach the nuns, and the nuns go to hear him, and the narrator tells us that because he thought that women are foolish, and have no intelligence. They will not be able to understand. So he gave them a very dumbed down teaching. And then the narrator tells us, but they were wise and they understood and asked him many questions. So the narrator, in this very, I think, important moment within the Vinaya is telling us that he's aware of the presence of misogyny in the minds of some of the bhikshus, and he's aware that it's not justified, he or she, whoever was narrating that particular story. So just to bear in mind that we have many moments in the text where perhaps some of the assumptions that we may have about what the view of the narrators might be on women, none of them can actually be sustained finally, because there are such a range of positions that we see the narrator taking. And one bhikshuni that I know who I mentioned that I was working on these narratives describing Buddha's interactions and with his female disciples, and particularly with the nuns, and looking at the relations between the bhikshu and the bhikshuni communities, commented to me very early on that I don't know if I really want to know what's in there. So we do have certain assumptions about what the texture and what the tone and what the attitudes are going to be, which when we allow ourselves to look at the fullness of the range of positions that the Vinaya is offering to us, the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya is offering to us, that really needs to be reconsidered. One of the stories, and if people know one story about bhikshunis from the Vinayas, it's always the same story, and that is the story of how Mahaprajapati requested bhikshuni ordination so many times, and Buddha said no, and then finally Ananda came, and then Buddha is quoted as making statements that, you know, that indicate that he did it with great reluctance. All right, so this is the story that's told again and again and again. And again, we have the issue of politics of representation, what we choose to tell ourselves as the dominant narrative. That for that reason, certainly in this lecture, I'm not going to retell that story, although now I've just retold it slightly. But for us to have an opportunity to see that actually that story is contained within the Vinaya, but it is absolutely overwhelmed by many, many other stories that tell a very different story about what the relationships were. And I'd like to turn to one story where we can see again that gender issues are on the radar of the narrators of the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. And it is a story in which Mahaprajapati Gautami plays an important role. It takes place in Kapilavastu, and the Buddha has returned. He's giving teachings in the afternoon, in the morning and in the afternoon, and King Suddhodana is surrounded by 500 of the leading citizens of Kapilavastu. All of the luminaries of the town are turning out for the teachings. And one of the leading merchants from the city of Kapilavastu, whose name is Mahanaman, the famous one, he comes home and he's sort of overflowing with enthusiasm for the teachings. And he's saying, wow, the Buddha is so wonderful, the Dharma is so wonderful, this is... You know, we're receiving the nectar of the Dharma, and it's so sweet, and it's just, you know, he's praising it in this, you know, this sort of euphoric way to his wife. And his wife says, let me see if I can get the exact quote. His wife says, so Mahanaman has said specifically, he says, ah, the Buddha, ah, the Dharma, ah, the Sangha, how fruitful is the arising of the Buddha for us. And then his wife says to him, noble son, this is the way a good wife addresses her husband, what is this? And he says, today in front of an assembly of many hundreds, the Lord taught the Dharma in such a way that upon hearing it, many hundreds of thousands of beings attained great insights. And she says, noble son, what you say, that the arising of the Buddha is fruitful for you, is true. The arising of the Buddha is fruitful only for you, not for us. As for why that is, it is because the arising of the Buddha in the world is for the sake of men, not for women. And Mahanaman is, of course, you know, very, very distressed. And he says, good lady, which is how a good husband addresses his wife, don't say that. The Lord has compassion for all beings. You should go too and listen to the Dharma from the Lord in person. And she explains, she replies that since His Majesty is surrounded by all of the assembly of leading shakyas of the city, we would feel shy listening to the Dharma directly in front of the Buddha. But if His Majesty, if the men, would go in the morning, we could listen to the Dharma from the Lord in the afternoon. So Mahanaman decides that he immediately wants to make that happen. He says, I'll go and inform the king. And then he has the thought, that would be awkward for me to go and ask on behalf of my own wife. But Mahaprajapati is highly esteemed by the king. He listens to whatever she says and considers that it should be done as she says. So I'll present the matter to her. So he goes and he explains to Mahaprajapati what's happened. And she says, you know, she says that she will take care of it, basically. Then the women, the wife of Mahanaman, who's not named, and comes with a group of many other Shakya women and also approaches Mahaprajapati and explains that they would like to listen to the Dharma, but that the king should go in the afternoons, in the morning rather, so they can go in the afternoon. And Mahaprajapati then goes to King Suddhodana and informs him that I've heard that the Lord has been teaching in the morning and in the afternoon, and that it's very wonderful, and that this assembly is listening to the sweet, sweet Dharma from the Buddha. And the Shakya women have also heard of this, and they would also like to hear the Dharma. Now, therefore, Your Majesty, his queen is saying to the king, Mahaprajapati is saying to King Suddhodana, that you should go in the morning, since women are busy with housework in the morning, but we can go in the afternoon. So you go in the morning and leave the afternoons free for us. And the narrator tells us, as was the practice of King Suddhodana, when Mahaprajapati Gautami was giving orders, he remained standing with his body stiff as a rod, and the king did not sit down until Mahaprajapati Gautami had completed her giving of orders. With his head bowed, he said, Gautami, so shall it be. So we have this very vivid presentation. This is not a story that's told because it relates to any rules. This is just the narrative delight of the Mula Srivastavada Vinaya in describing the world that it's coming from. And we have the image, which we can tell from other descriptions, that the way he's describing the king is how a servant stands in the presence of his or her master with head bowed, receiving the orders, and does not sit down until the orders have been completed. So we have this very vivid, visible presentation of Mahaprajapati Gautami that is very, very different from how she emerges from when the narrative that we hear is of her bowing before the Buddha, being turned down, and then crying outside the gate of the monastery because she's been turned down for vows. Here you see her in all her glory. She is a force to be reckoned with. Now, I think more important than that, this text is giving us a very startling and striking articulation of awareness of the gender position of women because of their household duties, and awareness that they are, because they are cut off from the public sphere in which these teachings are being given, although it may be true that the Buddha is teaching for everyone, if the social conditions are not created for them to actually come to receive the teachings, then that statement cannot be fully true, that the Buddha is benefiting everyone, according to her perspective. And so we also see that from the very beginning, the wife of Mahanaman is speaking for all women. She's saying for us. She understands herself to be a member of a group. And the initiative that's taken in order to redress the situation, Mahanaman himself is the one who goes out into the public sphere to try to do something about it. He goes, and initially he's going to speak with the king. He goes instead to speak with Mahaprajapati. But the women don't leave it. They don't allow him to just be their voice. They themselves also go separately afterwards to Mahaprajapati, and the request is expressed in that way. Now, the other interesting moment that we see is that the nature of the request is shifted slightly in terms of the explanation given for why. So the householder Mahanaman's wife needs to explain to him, since he seems not to understand, that women are, you know, not comfortable going into that public sphere because of all of the social dynamics. She says, I would be very embarrassed. And, you know, very quickly, Mahanaman could then think, yes, if my wife were to go into the public assembly, that is not what a respectable woman does. So he gets it when, once it's reminded that, how would I feel? I would be very shy to do that, you know, because I'm a respectable woman, is the subtext. But when Mahaprajapati presents it to the king, she doesn't present it in terms of any kind of discomfort or shyness or timidity on the part of women. She gives it this very practical but also gendered explanation, which is the women are doing the housework, so they can't go at that time. She doesn't need to explain to the king it's not appropriate in our world for the women and the men to go into a mixed public setting. And so we have this, we see that the husband, that Mahanaman himself, is apparently unaware of the way that social issues are limiting the opportunities that she has, but she sees it and is willing to do something about it, and so are all of the other women involved in the story. So the ideology of inclusiveness that the Buddha is articulating and that Mahanaman understood needs these other interventions, very particular local interventions, in order to be fulfilled. So we can, the story is telling us that the Buddha wants to address women, he's waiting to address women, but men as well as women need to be involved in creating the social conditions for him to do so. And this story goes on and describes after Mahaprajapati leads the women to a series of teachings for them in the afternoon at which the men are not present. During that teaching that ensues, There's a servant girl who very much wants to receive the teachings, and we hear the narrator tells her all of her thoughts and what she's thinking, but her mistress keeps sending her back home for different things. And so she's having these thoughts that it's so terrible to be a servant girl. The one thing I want is to hear the teachings, and I keep having to leave. It's, you know, I mean, I have no merit. That's why I'm in this terrible position. And when the servant girl is leaving on one of those occasions, the Buddha writes, so in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya there is writing according to the presentation of these stories. He writes on a leaf a verse, and he offers that verse written on a leaf to the servant girl. So the stories are that we find in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya are really telling us something very different about the Buddha's attitude towards women and his role as a caretaker. Now, I want to fast forward from the time when they received their first story, their first teaching from the Buddha, and skip over the intervening stories that describe how they came then later to become bhikshunis. And I want to then look at the things that happen after the vows are conferred into the mind stream of women, or after they are formally granted ordination as bhikshunis, because the granting of vows is obviously a very important moment in the process of making a bhikshuni. But certainly in the narratives of the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, that is not the only thing that has to happen in order for the bhikshuni community to be formed and to flourish. There are many, many other interventions that the Buddha makes and that the nuns themselves make and that the lay people have to accept and participate in order for a woman to be able to function and to live in the world as a bhikshuni. So both in terms of forming the community and in terms of having nuns actually become bhikshunis in the fullest sense, the process of conferring the vow is just one moment. It is not the sum totality. And I want to draw a little bit of attention to this aspect of the complexity of the process and to this question today, because a lot of the discourse that we see around bhikshuni ordination is focused on how we can have a valid ordination ceremony that would result in those women legally being bhikshunis. And the resistance that we have, we can imagine it as a sort of a legal debate. And so the people who, the monks, the bhikshus who have, up until this point decided not to do it have been explaining reasons that come from the ordination procedure. And I think it's worth considering that the resistance to granting bhikshuni ordination is not just about the legality of the ordination ceremony, but that is obviously much less directly, but also very importantly, about whether or not it's considered a good thing to have the women in Buddhist communities to be full participants and holders of the Vinaya and of the Buddha Dharma. And so when our discussions about bhikshuni ordination are limited or unduly focused on the question of whether or not the ceremony or the procedure would be valid, we may not actually be talking about the actual issues. And the other reason why I think it's worth spending some time with the stories that talk about what the lives and the community activities were like after the Buddha did grant Mahaprajapati and the other Shakya women his permission to become bhikshunis, is that you know, one of the issues is the, you know, that perhaps it's difficult to imagine, you know, that maybe, you know, the challenge is not solely figuring out a valid legal ordination, but being able to envision women as full participants in Buddhist monasticism. And what the Mula Savastavada Vinaya does offer to those who read it or who listen to some of its stories is that it is offering it is educating our imagination so that we can begin to think about the possibilities and to imagine what it would be like to have the fourfold community of the Buddha's disciples fully active. And, you know, we have this resource at our disposal that is the very first thing that we find in the Tibetan Buddhist canon, in which women are not only granted permission by the Buddha, but they are treated as fully adequate candidates to become full holders of the Vinaya. So the second set of stories that I want to look at have to do with a challenge that we see the Mula Savastavada Vinaya describing, which is that at the time, as it's presented within the text at the time of the Buddha, there were not understood to be other, that the spiritual life was not considered a way of life valid for women. Now, there are many narratives in which there are the female renunciates from other orders are meant to be there. But by and large, the career options that, to put it that way, that are open to women in the world of the Mula Savastavada Vinaya are they can be daughters, they can be wives, they can be mothers. If those are not the identities that they have, the other paths that are open to them are basically two, as presented in the Vinaya, either prostitutes or courtesans, however, whichever term we decide is appropriate, or beggars. And for this reason, when a woman is outside the household, when she's outside the domestic sphere, there's a lot of confusion as to, is she a beggar or is she a prostitute? What else could she actually be? And the role of a bhikshuni, what it is to be a bhikshuni, was something that needed to be understood, it needed to be articulated, and it needed to be defined and defended. And there is, within the Bhikshuni Vibhanga in particular, and the story that I was just narrating of the Shakya women being led by Mahaprajapati comes from the Sangha Vastu. It does not come from the Bhikshuni Vibhanga, the volume of the Vinaya that's devoted to Bhikshunis. This set of stories do happen to come from this particular volume. And there are a number of them, which have a very similar pattern. There's some bhikshuni, most often Stulananda, are handy, naughty nun. Anytime anything naughty needs to happen, there's a very good chance that it was her. Transgressive needed to happen, there's a good chance that it was her. She will go to a home and she will engage in some sort of activity that is the domain of a wife or a woman of the household. She will engage in that activity, and then later Mahaprajapati will come to the same house and will be asked to perform that same function. And Mahaprajapati then will articulate in very clear terms to the lay people, that is not what a bhikshuni does. So it's not, you know, it's not understood to be an automated process that they become bhikshunis and, okay, now they're bhikshunis, everyone understands how to interact with them. That needed to be defined carefully, slowly. And so two of the areas that we see confusion about how, what it means to have a female renunciate knocking on the door, not knocking on the door, figuratively knocking on the door, what it means that they're approaching, or what it means that there is a woman who is moving in the public sphere independently, not, you know, not staying within the household. There are two sorts of confusion. So bhikshunis are, the role of bhikshunis is confused or conflated with the role of beggars or domestic servants. So a beggar who would be presumably willing to perform some service in exchange for food, or as prostitutes. And they're both of these, the question of defining the role of a bhikshuni as a female figure, a woman who is moving outside the household, but is neither a prostitute nor a beggar. These areas of conflation of roles, the slippage across the boundaries in the minds of people who are perceiving them, needs to be clarified and shored up again and again. And so, just to look at these set, they're sort of charter stories for stopping the slippage of the role of a bhikshuni from sliding into these other options, social options for women outside the household. And so just to look at one, there's one where Stulananda, who's makes her very, she's very funny. It's funny to read what she does. She comes to a house, and it's a mess. And she looks at the house and she says to the woman, "Don't you know how to do this? Don't you know how to take care of a house?" And the woman says, "Do you know?" And she says, "Is there anything I don't know? Is there any art or skill that I lack?" And so the woman says, "If you know, could you do it for me?" And then, you know, in each of these different stories, Stulananda is saying basically, "Okay, but, you know, I'll need some really good food for that." And sometimes she demands food also to, for a period of time afterwards, "I'll do this for you, but then for the next week you have to guarantee me food, or you have to give me food for me and also for my other friends, the other bhikshunis that I live with, or the shamanericas." So in this case she does, and she, you know, and the text itself knows about domestic service, it knows about the work of housekeeping, so they explain how she polished, you know, she polishes all the metal and how she cleans the house in this very rapid period of time. And finally, the woman is very satisfied and gives the food. And then the husband comes home and is impressed by how well she's cleaned it. And then she says, "Well, I didn't do it. Stulananda did." And he said, "Then you should get her to do this every day." So there's the willingness of the bhikshuni to help in these areas is, you know, constitutes in the minds of the lay people, an acceptance of the role of bhikshuni as partial domestic servant. So then Mahaprajapati comes along, and the woman asks her if she could help with the housework while she's going to get the food. And Mahaprajapati, we've seen a little bit of her character in the story, in her engagement with King Suddhodana. She says to this woman, the woman who's asking her to perform domestic service, she says, "Sister, if I did not work even as Suddhodana's domestic servant, will I do it now that I've gone forth?" She says, "Not to mention that by accumulating so much that's non-meritorious by speaking this way to a holder of ethical conduct, you are producing the seed to be a slave. Moreover, have you ever heard of a bhikshuni who's willing to work as a servant?" And then the woman says, "Stulananda." And then this comes back to the Buddha. And the Buddha then makes a rule saying this is not to be done. So the formal legislative procedure is, the rule is made when Buddha utters it as a rule. But Mahaprajapati herself is involved in defining what a bhikshuni does and doesn't do. And There's a similar story where Stulananda has gone in and has gone to a house where the woman has a newborn infant and has no idea how to take care of it, and she does, and it explains how you clear the mucus from the nostrils and how you put a baby to sleep and how you bathe the child. And so later, Mahaprajapati comes to the same house and is asked to bathe the child. And Mahaprajapati again says, "Sister, I have bathed the Bodhisattva. After that, I wash no other child. To speak like this to a bhikshuni endowed with ethical conduct, are you further increasing your karma to be a servant?" So this, and it happens again with another nun, with spinning. So in these stories, although it's the Buddha who is making laws for the community, Mahaprajapati Gautami is in the front line, clarifying for the lay people and for other bhikshunis what a bhikshuni is and what a bhikshuni does. Now, one point that I think is very, very noticeable and interesting is that these stories are not just about defining what a bhikshuni is, and they are not simply about Mahaprajapati discussing gender roles, and all of the activities that she's being asked to do are things that she's being asked to do because they are women's work. So Mahaprajapati is basically saying you can think of two social categories. There's gender, by which human beings are divided into men or women, male or female. But there's also the category within the Buddhist world, there's another strong category whereby human beings are divided, which is monastics and non-monastics. And what Mahaprajapati is saying to the laywoman that between these categories, the category of gender and the category of monastic versus lay, the stronger category is monastic versus lay. So when you're dividing up, the fact that I'm a woman does not count. What counts is the fact that I'm a bhikshuni. But we have another category, another social marker that Mahaprajapati is signaling in her response to these women, which is the very particular social class to which class or caste to which Mahaprajapati belongs. So she is not just any woman who's become a vishuni. She was the queen. And she was the foster mother of the Buddha. She bathed the Buddha. And so you can see how incredibly powerful it must have been in terms of being able to articulate an identity, a new role in society of bhikshuni, whose most prominent figure is already in a very, very socially elevated position and also very far from domestic service. And so just in terms of, you know, to kind of think ahead to the process of forming bhikshuni orders in cultures where there have been no bhikshunis, whether across the Himalayas or in different Theravada communities, that when, you know, what happened in the Mula Srivastavada Vinaya's presentation of the Indian situation where bhikshuni order was first being formed, it really, you can see there were moments where it was a very key thing that the person who was the face to society was someone who they are already inclined to respect because of her social vocation, apart from being the foster mother of the Buddha or aunt of the Buddha. Now, not only in terms of what sort of role a woman can have in society and where bhikshuni relates to the other sorts of careers available to women, there's also the fact of women's vulnerability physically to male predators. And this is a point of anxiety that women who in a society where respectable women are not disconnected from a male, they're not independent of any male, they're either a daughter or a wife or a mother, or they are in some sense vulnerable. This is the imagining, the social imagining of the Mula Sarvastivada Vini itself. So in this kind of a context, when women are going alone on alms rounds, there are many, many narratives where they are vulnerable. There's one nun, a bhikshuni named Kapila Bhadra, who's extraordinarily beautiful, and she is, in one set of stories, she is the victim of sexual assault. But even before that, on her alms round, the narrator tells us the men look at her and they say, "We can consume her even without touching her," and they're ogling her, and this makes her uncomfortable. And she discusses it with Mahakashyapa, to whom she had been formerly married before they both ended up being monastics, and he ends up dividing his food with her. So the fact that women are either are objects in the male gaze that can be predatory even when there's not a sexual assault involved is fully in the awareness of the narrators of the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. And what ends up happening again and again is we see in various instances when women are subject to some sort of harassment or physical or sexual assault by men, the Buddha intervenes and serves as their protector. And this can happen in a wide range of ways. One story where this happens is Maha Prajapati has been on alms round, and preceding her to a certain household, a Brahmin has approached asking for alms, and they tell him to go away. But then Maha Prajapati comes, and the woman of the housewife has this thought, this is the mother of the Buddha. She's the head of the Dikshuni order, and she's coming to my house. And she rushes and she gets fine food and she offers it to Maha Prajapati. And the Brahmin has been watching this, and he's seething with rage and with envy. And when Maha Prajapati comes out, he asks her, "Oh, what kinds of fine things do you have in your bowl?" And she shows it to him, and he spits in the bowl. And she says to him, "Why did you do that? There was no need for you to do that. If you had asked, I would have given it to you." And this is reported to the Buddha, and the Buddha says that other men too can mistreat women. And so he creates a rule saying that bhikshunis are allowed to put a cover on their begging bowl. So this is one of the gentler moments in which the Buddha is intervening to accommodate or to factor in the vulnerability, the physical vulnerability of nuns to men. And he says specifically that other men can do things that are harmful to women. Then, so this, I want then to look at a story of a former prostitute, a woman who becomes a prostitute, and just to notice that prostitutes appear as figures in every single one of the 13 volumes of the Vinaya. They are part of that world. To just note that Stephanie Jameson, who works primarily with Brahminical materials, Dharmashastra, she notes that the Brahminic response to the challenge posed by the female ascetic, so this includes bhikshunis, is to depict her as a woman of dubious morals, associating with questionable people, on the fringe, dwelling on the fringes outside respectable life. And she describes this as a strategy that's used by Brahminical texts against the Buddhist order in general, and also against this new spiritual career that the Buddha is making available for women, and that so she's looking from an outside perspective how at the reactions that are prompted by the presence of Buddhist bhikshunis in the Buddhist order. And also we can note that there is a lot of concern within the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, both about women's vulnerability to rape, their vulnerability to be confused, misunderstood as being prostitutes. Now, in terms of the Buddha's, how the Buddha is presented as relating to this issue, there's a story, a couple of stories that maybe we can move through a little bit quickly, where a woman who's been, I think in her case, we'll translate it as prostitute, she has been, she has an encounter with Mahamudgalyayana, and based on the exchange of verses and a very visceral teaching that he gives her, she decides to ordain. And Mahamudgalyayana finally takes her to the Buddha and tells the Buddha that she wishes to ordain. Now, at this point, King Bimbisara approaches and basically says to the Buddha, "What is this prostitute doing here?" And do I have this quote? The Buddha responds to King Bimbisara and says, "Maharaja, do not say this. She is your Dharma sister and is seeking renunciation, full ordination, and bhikshunihood." So there are a lot of different things that we can learn from this story. One of them is that this narrative is telling us very clearly that the transformation of her status, which has not yet taken place, from being a prostitute, and she was with clients when she met Mahamudgalyayana, with a large group of clients when she met him. So she, just up until that moment, she had been engaged in this activity. She comes, she's not ordained yet, but already the fact that she has requested ordination and she's going to be ordained is enough for the Buddha to insist to King Bimbisara, who's the king of Rajagriha, that this is your sister. So the idea is that the pending transformation to a bhikshuni is sufficient to erase the personal history of being a prostitute. And King Bimbisara accepts this without question. And at this time, the Buddha had been writing a letter to Mahaprajapati that to authorize the ordination of Utpalavarna. Now, you can see that in this story that it's understood she's a prostitute, she's a very famous prostitute in the city, and if the king recognizes immediately that that's who and what she is. So there's this understanding that if his authorization of the ordination might need to be confirmed in writing, right? So the king asked, "Lord, to whom are you writing the letter?" And he says, "Great king, to Mahaprajapati, who's in Shravasti." And then the king says, "I myself will safeguard its delivery to her." And then the Buddha says, "Great king, that would be perfect." So in a sense, the Buddha has orchestrated this situation. He's engineered a situation in which the king himself is supporting and sort of authorizing in this very public way that he understands and is also accepting that she is not a prostitute anymore and she's going to become a bhikshuni. No, there's nothing formal about any rule being involved in this. This is just an instance of the Buddha's skill in handling these situations. And it also clearly shows that the Buddha is willing to stand up and protect, in a certain sense, the nuns from that sort of verbal treatment. Now, when the nun who ordains is Upalavarna, and she will go on to be designated by the Buddha as the foremost among his bhikshunis for Riddhi, for her extraordinary powers, for her meditative powers. And she is, in that sense, the counterpart to Mahamoggayayana, who had first taught her the Dharma. But at a certain point later, she's an incredible meditator, and she's meditating in solitary places by herself. And at one point, a Brahmin seeks her out, and this Brahmin had approached her many years before, or some time before, some unspecified time before, wanting her services while she was still working. And she had told him he had come with some ritual humble offerings that he had as being a Brahmin. And she said, when you come with 500 Karshapana coins, then I will entertain your request. So he comes much later and he seeks her out in the forest and he gives her he sort of puts down the 500 or displays the 500 Karshapanas and says, this is the 500 Karshapanas. I want to purchase your services. And she says to him, Palavarna says to him, I have abandoned that which is not the holy Dharma. And she says this, and he says to Utpalavarna, maybe you have abandoned it, but I haven't. Now, Utpalavarna, Utpala is a lotus that's called blue, but it's sort of blue-purple, and her eyes are said to be the color of Utpala's. So she says to the Brahmin, to what part of my limbs, to what part of my body are you so extremely attached? And he says, your eyes. So by her extraordinary powers, she places her eyes on the palm of her hand, and she says to the Brahmin, if you desire it, take it. So the Brahmin sees her eyes in the palm of her hand, and he becomes angry, and he punches her in the head, and he leaves. So she's not sexually assaulted, but she is physically assaulted. And this particular incident becomes the basis for the Buddha to lay down the rule saying that to implement a rule saying that bhikshunis are not to live in solitary places. So that rule is created based on her exchange. So this is a very, very rich story, and very sadly we don't really have time to explore it very much. But we see from the Buddha's intervention that he recognizes that women are physically vulnerable to male predators, and he accepts the role of placing them under his protection, not allowing them to be in isolated places where they cannot be protected. This move that he makes to place himself in taking ownership, in a sense, of the nuns' community with his legislating is also, we also see this in many smaller interventions where issues, not only where bhikshunis need protection from male, lay, non-ordained predators, who are very often described as sexual predators, but he also intervenes many, many times to protect the nuns from the bhikshunis from being made into servants of the bhikshus. And there we can see in the Vinaya many, many incidents where bhikshus are somehow getting the bhikshunis to wash their clothes, to dye their robes, to spin their yarn, many, many different services that the Buddha, again, is articulating to the bhikshus that that's not permissible. Now, sometimes the family relationships are acknowledged within this set of identities that the Buddha is articulating and setting boundaries for, that sometimes the rule says that a bhikshu cannot ask a bhikshuni who's not his relative to perform such and such service. But we do see the Buddha also very much making it clear that the bhikshunis, not only are they not domestic servants to lay people, certainly, but they're also not domestic servants to the bhikshus. And so one of the things to note here is that the roles need defining, and the position of women as ownerless, and this is a phrase that comes again and again in the Mula Savastavada Vinaya in many different contexts. People ask women, "Whose are you? Who do you belong to?" And they will say, "I'm the daughter of so and so. I'm the wife of so and so." People are criticizing things that happens in the community when, for example, when someone becomes insane and is behaving in an insane way, one of the criticisms that the lay people make is that the sons and daughters of the Shakyas are protectorless. No one takes care of them. So having gone out of the family relationships, who owns you? Who do you belong to? And so the Buddha says in many, many different ways, in different words, but primarily through these interventions, he's saying, "I own them. You're mine. You are sons of this lineage. Right? You are my sons and daughters," or outside, not necessarily in a family relationship, he is stepping in as the protector. Now, he also, in many other interventions, makes the bhikshus the protectors of the bhikshunis, but at the same time, the Buddha is protecting the bhikshunis from misuse of that authority as the owners or the protectors of the bhikshunis. So many of the narratives that we read can present the bhikshunis in a position of where if you look at the hierarchy that is being presented, it looks as if it's Buddha, bhikshus, bhikshunis, lay community. I want to turn very briefly to one last story about that shows a different way of understanding the structuring or the hierarchy among these different communities, where a leading merchant in the city is sitting on the roof of his house with his cheek in his hand, and his wife asks him what's wrong, and he says, "We have so many things, but none of this wealth will come with us when we go to our next life." And so they come up with the idea of making a big offering, big food offering, big dana to Buddha and the bhikshu community. And so they do that. And afterwards, and it's described in this formulaic way, but in quite a lot of detail, how it happens. And afterwards, he's very, very happy, and he's rejoicing on the roof, and he says to his wife, now we can really rejoice. Now we truly have provisions that we can take with us on the journey to the next life. And the wife says to the husband, you have those provisions. I don't have those provisions. And he says to her, but don't we own everything in common? And she says, that's true, but still, I would like to make an offering to Mahaprajapati and to the Bhikshuni Sangha. And the husband says to her, why not? Just because we've made one offering doesn't mean we can't make a second one. And so then follows a very detailed description using exactly the same language. In translating it, I cut it and pasted and just swapped out the Buddha and put in Mahaprajapati, and swapped out Bhikshu and put in Bhikshuni, because the descriptions were very, very explicitly and intensely parallel. And this is, we could bring in quite a number of other moments in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya where the Bhikshunis are teaching specifically for women. They teach in ways that are addressing particularly women's experiences. The Bhikshunis are presented as the caretakers of the lay women community, and men are protectors. The Bhikshus are protectors and teachers of the Bhikshu community. Now, the Bhikshus can also teach the lay women, but Bhikshunis, as we've seen, can also teach lay men, you know, when a woman who understands is present, according to the last formulation of that particular rule. So there's also, this is a phenomenon also that Peter Skilling has noticed and described, and he's coined a very, very useful phrase, which is gender pairing, where what the Bhikshus and the Bhikshunis are like twins. Okay, they parallel, they're shadowing each other's activities. And we can see this in many, many ways, and I strongly recommend looking at Peter Skilling's article on this. I have the reference on your screen. There are some texts that exist for Bhikshus, and then they exist for Bhikshunis. They like the Tarigata and the Tarigata. There's also the list of the foremost among the Bhikshu community. There's a similar parallel list for the Bhikshuni community. And so this other set of treatments of Bhikshunis in their relationship to women and in their relationship to Bhikshus offers an entirely different set of perspectives that we can take, or ways that we can think about what a Bhikshuni is and where her place in society was, what her relationships are like. And so I think, I didn't check the time when I started, but I think that's about how much time we have. I think, you know, one of the points that I think are important to take away is that the rules in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya do not exist in a vacuum. The text went to great pains, and literally, you know, we're not in a print culture, we're in a manuscript culture, where for all of the centuries that this text continued to circulate, you know, within in Sanskrit, it was, and in the Indian subcontinent, there are 8,000 pages that are being written out by hand each generation in a monsoon culture that the manuscript needs to be replaced. Tremendous amount of work is being done to keep the narrative density as part of the Vinaya. And the rules are transmitted in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, except in the Pratimoksha Sutra when the list is recited. The rules are not separate from these very particular, very detailed and specific situations in response to which that rule arose. And the text itself is preserving the history of revisions of the of those rules that were revised. And so when we are, first of all, when we're thinking about the relationship of the Vinaya to actual lived experience, which is never universal, all experience is particular experience, that when we're thinking about that relationship, to understand that the text itself did not appear to want the rules to be abstracted from those contexts. And the other point that can be useful for our thinking now, in terms of imagining what some of the challenges will be within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and also for thinking about some of the challenges that are being faced in other contexts where Bhikshuni ordination is now being newly established, that there is a process of evolution of articulating for others and for themselves what it means to be a Bhikshuni, what it actually means. And when we're trying to work out what are the sorts of relationships to the Bhikshu community, what are the sorts of relationships to the lay community, I think to understand that we have a canonical resource that is offering us a very wide range of options for how we think about gender, how we think about the position of Bhikshunis relative to Bhikshus, relative to the lay community, relative to each other, and that these options are available to us if we're willing to engage with the narrative material and we're willing to start imagining them. And we don't need to prove, actually, that some of the stories, some of the positions that are described are wrong. We don't need to prove that one is the only way of doing it, because we are in a Vinaya world in which we are responding to circumstances. We know that we need to embody the monastic way of life in very different times now and in very different local conditions, local different from how they were at that time, but also different from place to place geographically and socially, and that we don't need to settle on one particular vision, that the Vinaya is offering us a range of visions, and it contains within it the permission and, in fact, the encouragement to us to find that voice and that set of visions within the Vinaya that is suited for us to live a Buddhist monastic life, for us to imagine introducing Bhikshunis into different societies, that the resources are there. It's really up to us to educate ourselves and to understand that we are selecting, although it is one authoritative text, that there are many, many voices within the text and many, many different positions that the text itself could authorize. Which of those are chosen is decided according to the Vinaya itself based on circumstances and needs. So I think I'd just like to leave you with that. I'm pretty sure my time is done. And I also would like to thank very much Bhikkhu Anālayo for making this opportunity available for us to gain a much wider and richer understanding of this issue, and also for inviting me to be part of it. Thank you.